Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Well, here we are on Monday, and President Trump is poised to name a new White House chief of staff with the impending exit of John Kelly. The powerful position becomes even more political in the wake of Friday's monumental series of Mueller memos. What does the special counsel know that hides behind those full-page redactions in former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's sentencing memo, and the president's former lawyer Michael Cohen making, quote, secret and illegal hush money payments from the shadows at the behest of what New York prosecutors call Individual One? Well, that individual, the president, tweeted Friday, quote, totally clears the president, thank you. And he reiterated that optimistic assessment on Saturday morning.
On the Mueller situation, we're very happy with what we are reading because there was no collusion whatsoever.
Well, New York Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler, the likely next chair of the House Judiciary Committee, had a more sober appraisal of the situation on Sunday morning.
What these indictments and filings show is that the president was at the center of a massive fraud, several massive frauds against the American people.
This hour on Point, looking at what's to come in Washington and around the globe. And you can join us. What do you make of the latest developments in the Mueller probe? Who do you think should replace John Kelly as White House Chief of Staff? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Well, joining us today from Washington is James Homan. He's national political correspondent for The Washington Post, where he writes the Daily 202 newsletter. James, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
Also with us from Washington is Jennifer Williams, foreign editor at Vox and co-host of the weekly international podcast Worldly. Jennifer Williams, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us from Washington as well is Natasha Bertrand, staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers national security and the intelligence community. Natasha, it's always great to have you. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Natasha, let me just start with you. So we've had a couple of days here to chew over what was in those sentencing memos, both from the special counsel and the Southern District of New York. You heard the president there on Saturday being very confident and optimistic. But for others observing what was in the memo, what would the president or should the president be most worried about?
Well, it seems like he's been implicated directly by the Southern District of New York in making hush money payments to two women at the height of the election that the New York prosecutors called secret and illegal. Now, of course, we knew back in August when Michael Cohen pleaded guilty in the Southern District of New York to those campaign finance violations that he said at the time that he had done it at the direction of Donald Trump. So he had implicated him back then. But now this is the first concrete, evidence by the Southern District of New York saying that, no, Donald Trump was definitely implicated in this. Of course, they named him as Individual One, something that's kind of become a meme now on social media. But it's not to be taken lightly. I mean, this is a statement by prosecutors that the president, then candidate Donald Trump, essentially defrauded voters during the election in trying to keep his, affairs a secret. Another thing is that there were more contacts between the campaign and Russia than were previously known, including a discussion in the fall of 2015 about potentially connecting Trump to Putin when he was in New York for the UN General Assembly.
Right. More contacts and for a longer period of time, right?
Right. So this was at the time when Donald Trump was, pursuing a Trump Tower Moscow deal. Michael Cohen told radio host Sean Hannity that he would be open to meeting with President Putin. But it did not materialize for whatever reason. But they were still obviously pursuing this deal well into June 2016.
Mm-hmm. Well, James, let me turn to you because, regarding Michael Cohen and the Southern District of New York, we have heard the possibility that if New York prosecutors choose to, after the president leaves office, whether after a first or second term, they may have the option of charging him or indicting him. And so let's just play a little bit of tape here from California Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, likely the next chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He told CBS's Face the Nation yesterday that the president could be in serious trouble if he did indeed direct those illegal payments during the presidential campaign.
There's a very real prospect that on the day Donald Trump leaves office, the Justice Department may indict him, that he may be the first president in quite some time to face the real prospect of jail time.
But James, I mean, there's been no certainty of that whatsoever. So this is all just from, you know, one sentencing memo. So how has the calculus, you know, changed for the president, if at all?
Well, Magna, you have to be able to prove that the president willfully and knowingly violated the law by directing Cohen. The prosecutors don't put this kind of thing in a charging memo unless they have some corroborating evidence. They're ethically bound to do so. They're not just taking Michael Cohen at his word. I do think it's a little premature to talk about what might happen after he leaves office,
right,
just because the Justice Department, the Attorney General would have to approve that. And you know, we saw Richard Nixon was never prosecuted for crimes committed during Watergate. When Barack Obama took office, they made a decision not to prosecute people from the Bush era for crimes related to enhanced interrogation, including lower level folks at the CIA. And so that is something that sort of hangs over this. It is an untested legal question of whether the president can be indicted while in office. There are two Justice Department memos, but the Supreme Court has never weighed in on it. The Justice Department has never tested it. What we do know, though, is that Bob Mueller seems to be working under the assumption that he can't indict Trump. He's not going to try to do that. And that ultimately means that it would be up to Congress to do something. And that, frankly, is more of a political question than a legal one. It's a political standard. It's that you would drive impeachment, another word that Democrats avoided all this year, but we're starting to also hear mentioned on the Sunday shows.
Well, so let me ask you about that, because I think you're exactly right to bring up that point, that really the question at the heart of it at this moment is political, especially come January, right, when Democrats take the leadership in the House. But I mean, we're also hearing that, you know, if there are slightly louder whispers, of impeachment, that on the other hand, lots of key Republicans say, so what? When they impeached Bill Clinton, he just became more popular and ultimately was not removed from office. And so perhaps Congress has learned its lesson from that affair.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a lot of tension, more than I think is popularly understood, between Democrats. You have 30 House Democrats who are going to be up for re-election in 2020, which is right around the corner, 2 years from now, in districts that President Trump carried in 2016 when he's going to be on the ballot again. There's a lot of these new Democrats who are coming from places where the president is not as unpopular as he is nationally, and they don't want their first term in Congress to be defined by a fight over impeachment. On the other hand, you're going to have the White House, the new White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and the president's lawyer, Emmett Flood, plan to very aggressively use executive privilege. They're going to try and stonewall as much as they can to not turn over documents that these House Democrats, who now have subpoena power, are going to be demanding. And that is going to, I think, force Democrats' hands. And they're sort of banking on the fact that Democrats don't want to repeat the mistakes that were made by Republicans in the late 1990s, because remember, a lot of people like Nancy Pelosi were around and watched firsthand what happened to the GOP in 1998 and the leadership drama, Newt Gingrich gone, Bob Livingston gone, that unfolded after they decided to single-mindedly focus on removing Bill Clinton from power.
Right. So to that point, let's just play a little bit of tape here from New York Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler again. Again, he's the likely next chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He was on CNN's State of the Union yesterday, and you'll hear him hedging here a little bit as he describes what could be consequences if the president did indeed direct Michael Cohen to make those illegal hush money payments.
They would be impeachable offenses. Whether they are important enough to justify an impeachment is a different question, but certainly they'd be impeachable offenses, because even though they were committed before the president became president, they were committed in the service of fraudulently obtaining the office.
So, Jennifer Williams, to me, everything is in that line. Whether they are important enough to justify an impeachment is a different question here. So what's your take on all that we've been chewing over the weekend?
Exactly. That's one big caveat right there. And I think it makes it pretty clear that, you know, the straightforward question of whether this could be an impeachable offense, well, of course, you know, if he committed a felony or, you know, directed others to commit felonies in his name as well, that's absolutely something that, you know, would one would expect the Congress to hold the president accountable for. Again, I think it goes back to this political calculation of, you know, whether this is something that the Democratic base is going to be interested in and going to be fired up by. You know, I think there's a lot of conversation right now in the Democratic Party about, you know, the hashtag resistance, right? Like the resistance against Trump and trying to kind of bring him down at any cost or, you know, thwart him at any turn. But there's a lot of debate right now about whether that is something that is really going to resonate beyond the Democratic base and whether that's going to speak to kind of the broader, you know, middle class, working class kind of group of people that the Democrats really struggled to connect with in the last presidential election. And, you know, whether a more kind of positive, forward looking, you know, doing things on healthcare, doing things on jobs and things on infrastructure are going to be, you know, a bunch more resonant kind of message going into the 2020 election versus something that just looks like, you know, we are resisting, we are trying to stop Trump. And I think that's a serious question that the Democrats are having right now among themselves. I think they're going to start kind of trying to see how that resonates by, especially in the House Democrats, doing some new investigations, launching some new investigations. I know Adam Schiff in particular has said, you know, he's interested in bringing people back in that they had previously interviewed, you know, people like Michael Cohen, people who they now know have maybe lied. And so bring them back in and say, hey, we want to hear you again, and pushing and trying to see if they can, you know, make a little bit more headway in that investigation that the Republicans essentially closed down.
Right. And so when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about what was in Michael Flynn's sentencing memo. We can't really know because of its pages of redactions, but the significance of that as well. And we are talking about sort of chewing over what we know from those sentencing memos over the weekend. We're also will be talking about what's ahead for the White House and the West Wing with the impending departure of White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, and who the president may name in his place, and what kind of West Wing that would make for the next year, year and a half. And I'm speaking today with Jennifer Williams. She's foreign editor at Vox. Natasha Bertrand also joins us. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic. And James Homan is with us. He's national political correspondent for The Washington Post. And we want to hear from you. What's your reaction to the news over the weekend that John Kelly will be leaving the White House? Who would you like to see as the incoming White House chief of staff? And how would that change President Trump's administration or how he operates, if at all? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today about news to look for in the week ahead, especially given the announcement over the weekend that White House Chief of Staff John Kelly will be leaving that post at the end of this year. I'm joined today by Natasha Bertrand, by Jennifer Williams, and by James Homan. And Natasha, I just wanted to turn to you quickly before we sort of leave the Mueller sentencing memos behind here. And you've been following the Russia investigation so closely for a while. What was your first thought about the sentencing memo for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn with all of those redactions? Because I guess it just shows us how much the Mueller team knows, but we don't know what they know.
Yeah, it's hugely significant. I think that we were all pretty shocked to see all of this information coming out, because Michael Flynn has been completely silent for the entire year that he's been cooperating with the special counsel. So we didn't really know what to expect. And so when the memo came out with Mueller recommending that he serve no jail time at all for his lies to the FBI, for his failure to disclose his foreign lobbying operations in 2016, it was really jarring, because that means that he's been extremely helpful to Mueller's investigation. He also is assisting in several other investigations, which is a big piece of news to come out of that memo, including a criminal investigation and, you know, either another criminal investigation or perhaps a counterintelligence investigation. We don't know the nature of that because it was redacted. But just the fact that Flynn is now poised to be let off pretty much scot-free because of the extent to which he's been cooperating with the special counsel and the Justice Department more broadly is really remarkable. And I think that it should worry the president because, of course, Michael Flynn was at the center, at least during the transition, of all of the communication that happened between the campaign and the transition team and the Russians with regard to sanctions relief and the incoming policy of the incoming Trump administration. So he's a really central figure here in the Russia probe. And, you know, it's really curious that the president has not been tweeting about him and accusing him of making up lies, as he has done with Michael Cohen.
Yeah. Well, so Jennifer Williams, give us, if you can, what you might think the Russian view of all this is, right? Because we're talking about 14 potential points of contact with the Trump administration. And as Natasha just said, all that we don't know about what Michael Flynn has told the special counsel. I mean, Russian officials that I see quoted over the weekend still call this kind of a fantasy that Russia would have done anything. But what's your take on that?
Right. I think there are a couple of points. I think the first broader point on Russia is that if you're, you know, Vladimir Putin and you're sitting in the Kremlin, you're watching the kind of chaos that has played out, you know, the entire U.S. presidency kind of mired under this cloud of scandal and, you know, potential collusion and investigations, you're pretty happy in the sense that, you know, if one of the main goals, and that's what it says according to the intelligence community assessment, is that one of the goals of meddling in the 2016 election was essentially to create chaos and to create political division and to, you know, undermine democracy and undermine the faith in the presidency and elections and things like that. So on that one goal, you know, you've got to be pretty happy at looking at what you've been able to accomplish. But I think more specifically going, especially talking about Michael Cohen and the sentencing memos that we saw, you know, one of the things that we realized, you know, as we said earlier, is that these conversations with the Russians and between the Trump organization and the Russians went a lot longer, went a lot deeper into the campaign. And what that means is that you essentially have leverage if you're the Russians, right? If you know information that the president and his cohorts do not want made public, that's leverage. And that's a danger. Those are the kind of things, you know, when you go through a security clearance process, which the president doesn't just as policy, but others in his administration do. But if you go through a security clearance investigation, those are the specific kind of things that they look for to make sure that there isn't, you know, ways for foreign adversaries, for foreign governments and operatives to essentially, you know, hold something over you and say, you know, look, if you don't want this information to come out that's damaging to you, maybe you should play our game. Maybe you should play ball and do things we want to do. And sometimes it's as overt as that. Sometimes it's more insidious. But, you know, if you're the president and his cohorts and you know that the Russians may have more information that they're holding on to, you know, that's dangerous. That's dangerous for them. And it's dangerous for, you know, honestly, for the American people and for the way policy is being made. And to have faith that the president is acting, you know, for the best will of the American people and not to keep, you know, some various secrets hidden. So it's very scary.
Right. So this brings us then to who will be managing the White House, right? Because on Saturday, as we recall, President Trump confirmed that Chief of Staff John Kelly will be stepping down at the end of this year.
John Kelly will be leaving, but I don't know if I can say retiring, but he's a great guy. John Kelly will be leaving at the end of the year. We'll be announcing who will be taking John's place. It might be on an interim basis.
That's the president on Saturday. James, let me turn to you here. So many questions to ask about this, but let me first just start with we've just recently heard this news that the name that people had been bandying about of Nick Ayers, Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff, that Donald Trump, the president, may have been looking at to tap, that he has declined to do it. How significant is that?
It's a big deal because Trump had been talking with Nick about doing this for several months. Everyone assumed it was a done deal. In fact, a draft press release announcing Ayers' hire had already been drafted by the press shop. But the talk sort of fell apart on Sunday. And we're hearing it's because Ayers said he only wanted to stay for a few months, then go back to Georgia and lead the 2020 reelection campaign's super PAC. And there was mounting internal opposition. I think because there have been months of stories that Kelly was on his way out, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump were Nick Ayers' biggest proponents inside the White House, but a lot of other people, senior people threatening to leave, making the case against him to the president. And so I think Ayers was afraid of sort of if he stayed around too long, ending up like Kelly or Reince Priebus before that. So he wanted to have an exit strategy early on. Trump, I don't think, appreciated that. And so now Ayers will leave at the end of the year. Why that's significant, Meghna, is that there is no real obvious backup because the president really thought it was going to be Nick. So there's now 6 to 8 names, depending on who you talk to in the White House, being looked at. And what's sort of striking is that a bunch of the people who have wanted it in the past few months are saying, or people close to them are saying, that they no longer want it. And it's partly because of the conversation we've been having for the last several minutes, which is the storm clouds approaching, the Russia investigation getting closer to the White House. And there's sort of no obvious person to fill that void being left by Kelly's departure.
Well, so let's just talk a little bit more about that, right? Because, I mean, when Kelly was first named to the post in 2017, many people saw him as a great person for the job, to bring a little order and professionalism to White House operations. I mean, the president's critics said at least there, you know, would be an adult in the room, et cetera, et cetera. Now that the president has an opportunity to pick a new chief of staff, I'm seeing here a lot of discussion that it, especially given the Mueller investigation, that it will fully sort of form, or the West Wing will close ranks essentially and become a really political operation whose only goals are the president's reelection and dealing with the Mueller investigation. So in that case, there's zero chance that the president would pick someone who would be willing to sort of push him or stand up against him or guide him in a different direction.
Yeah, the names that are being mentioned are not disciplinarians. They're people who are going to let Trump be Trump. And Kelly actually was able to bring in place some discipline. He got rid of some of the most divisive and polarizing figures in the White House, from Anthony Scaramucci, who he fired on his first day, to Omarosa, to Steve Bannon. He was able to enforce some discipline, but eventually Trump got tired of that and it wore thin. I think one of the biggest knocks on Kelly that Trump made privately to people who he talked to, who I've talked to, is that he wasn't a political guy. He was a 4-star Marine general, but he wasn't he'd never worked on a campaign or anything. Nick Ayers, the former executive director of the Republican Governors Association, has run a bunch of campaigns, and I think Trump is very much in campaign mode. One of the names that's being mentioned, interestingly, increasingly too, is Mark Meadows,
right?
Exactly, yeah. And so he's someone he is on Capitol Hill, but he's the co-chair of the Freedom Caucus, the House Freedom Caucus, and he is disliked by most Republicans on Capitol Hill, even more than he's disliked by Democrats, because he's seen as sort of the president's base. He's on Fox News defending him all the time. And I think that would be a pick that wouldn't be about extending an olive branch to try and get stuff done on Capitol Hill. That would be entirely about how are we going to prepare for 2020 and make sure that the president's base is activated.
Yeah. Natasha, let me turn to you. Your thoughts on – I mean, the inevitability of John Kelly stepping down is one thing, but now the opportunity, or perhaps even vacuum, that it opens up is another. What's your take?
Yeah, so I do think that the president is obviously poised to place someone in there that's likely to be an enabler rather than a disciplinarian. But I also think it's the timing is really interesting. We just learned days before John Kelly stepped down, or perhaps right around the time it was announced or reported that he was going to, that he had actually spoken to the special counsel's team as part of the obstruction of justice investigation into the president. So I think that there's another calculation here for people perhaps being approached to take the chief of staff job, which is that they could be implicated and involved in this massive Russia investigation in a way that John Kelly may have been, because he, you know, may have had insight into the president's state of mind related to the Russia investigation and things that he could tell the special counsel about regarding, you know, what Trump's motivations were throughout the last, you know, year and a half that he's been there with regard to the tweets, et cetera, his relationship with Jeff Sessions, for example, all of that. So I think that that's really a telling piece of this, that anyone who goes into the White House automatically places themselves into that, you know, orbit and that fear that they could be caught up in this thing. And that's also why we see so many White House staffers trying so hard to divorce themselves from anything even relating to Russia, because they don't want to be in a position where they could be called by investigators and ask these questions.
It's a challenging post to fill when as you're all saying, anyone who does fill it will likely very quickly have to hire their own personal lawyer here. But I want to just talk for a quick second about Kelly himself, because, you know, he is respected, but also he's a complicated person, because he was actually in line with the president on several key issues in this administration, some of which, you know, received a lot of pushback from the public. For example, we were remembering that back in May, John Kelly told NPR in a wide-ranging interview about his view of family separation. And he said that it would be a tough deterrent for migrants attempting to cross the border. And he also said in that interview with NPR that a vast majority of people that move illegal to the United States are not bad people. But then he said this.
They're not criminals. They're not MS-13. But they're also not people that would easily assimilate into the United States. They're overwhelmingly rural people. In the countries they come from, fourth, fifth, sixth grade educations are kind of the norm. They're coming here for a reason, and I sympathize with the reason. But the laws are the laws.
That's John Kelly speaking to NPR in May. Jennifer, I wanted to turn to you on that because, I think the key thing there in that NPR interview is that John Kelly did not denounce family separation. He supported it as an effective deterrent there. So he wasn't at all out of step with the Trump administration, with the president himself. So the idea that he was, you know, he's been constantly this sort of counterbalancing force isn't necessarily true.
Right. I think that speaks to kind of a broader issue with the way Trump has staffed his White House and the way, you know, the dynamics of working for President Trump. You know, even if you are someone like John Kelly, who happens to have very similar views that are very close to the president on big, important issues, specifically immigration, which is, you know, obviously one of the things that Trump ran on and was most kind of effective in his messaging. Even someone like that, you know, you can end up being pushed out of the White House if, you know, you and Trump don't get along. I mean, there's reporting that towards the end, the two men weren't even speaking to each other. There was some reports that Kelly had called Trump an idiot in private conversations, speaking about the president. So I think it speaks to the kind of broader problem that it doesn't seem to be particularly pleasant to work for Trump. You know, I understand if you're trying to fill this White House chief of staff position, having, you know, the job description that you're going to be walking into. I think Natasha's totally right in terms of, you know, getting wrapped up in the Russia investigation. But you also have to look at, you know, what happened last week with Rex Tillerson, you know, the former Secretary of State. He and Trump didn't exactly get along too well during his time. And we have last week Trump tweeting out that, you know, calling Tillerson dumb as a rock and really being harsh to him publicly and just slamming him. We also saw that with Jeff Sessions while Jeff Sessions was still in his post, Trump actively kind of speaking out and slamming him and saying unkind things publicly. You know, for me, if I'm, you know, looking for my next big role in Washington, it doesn't seem like the Trump administration is really going to be the best place for me. I mean, you've seen time and time again, people go in thinking that this is going to be a big kind of political move for them and ending up disgraced or, you know, just kicked out or just kind of verbally abused during their time with Trump. And it just doesn't seem like a particularly pleasant job that you would want to have. So it doesn't surprise me that he's having trouble finding someone.
Well, let's take a quick call here if we can. Paul is calling from South Portland, Maine. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that the president is he's likely profiting from office. So he's likely been breaking emoluments rules. And it just seems to me that the Congress has sworn to uphold the Constitution. If the president has broken laws, they have to begin impeachment proceedings. And the media also, if Congress start strategizing and saying, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't begin impeachment proceedings because people will be mad at us. I don't think that they have the liberty to do that because they've sworn to uphold the Constitution. And if they do so, the media shouldn't just sit by and say, oh, okay, they just decided not to do it.
Mm. Paul, Paul, thank you for your call. James, we've got about a minute to go here before the break. What do you think?
Well, I think the media is aggressively covering everything that's happening. It's not our job to decide. We're just helping people understand what's going on and the dynamic. I think we're doing it well. The thing to his point about impeachment, as I said early on in this hour, it's a political decision, not a legal decision. The Constitution says high crimes and misdemeanors. It doesn't outline what those are. It doesn't say that violating the Emoluments Clause is an impeachable offense explicitly. And so it is ultimately up to Congress. Throughout our nation's 200 plus year history, the impeachment clause has only come into question three times.
Mm. Well, we are talking about the news to watch for in the week ahead. And I'm joined today by James Homan. He's national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Jennifer Williams is with us, too. She's foreign editor at Vox. And Natasha Bertrand is joining us. She is the staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers national security. We want to hear from you. What are you keeping your eye on in the week ahead? What's your reaction to John Kelly stepping down? And what changes might that bring to the White House? And when we come back, we'll talk about Brexit and the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia vis-a-vis Yemen. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the news to look for in the week ahead. And I'm joined today by James Homan, Jennifer Williams, and Natasha Bertrand. Let's go to a caller here. John is calling from Detroit, Michigan. John, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Meghna. So would it be safe to say that in the last 2 years of this administration that the pickings for his administration, he came in promising to drain the swamp, and he put in very, very questionable, not so much Jack Kelly, but a lot of his picks were very questionable. Would it be safe to say that at this point in time, we're going to get the bottom of the barrel, if any?
Mm. Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Natasha, let me turn to you. John calls it the bottom of the barrel, but you know, some of the names that James was telling us beforehand in terms of who might replace John Kelly, include the head of the Freedom Caucus in the House. So, what's your response to the caller there?
Yeah, so I definitely think that there will be some people who will want to have a position in this White House, especially if it's more politicized. People like Mark Meadows, for example, who has been a staunch ally of the president since he came into office, really. But I think that we're reaching a new level of desperation here. I mean, the Republicans are also getting kind of jittery about the president's – the kind of drip that's coming out of the Mueller investigation. There was a big piece in the Washington Post about how Republicans are preparing to jump ship. That may be too strong to say at this point, and we've seen them not really push back against the president in any meaningful way. But if the revelations keep flowing as they are now, then who knows what could happen. And so I do see this president and the administration becoming increasingly isolated. Whether or not that means they'll reach the bottom of the barrel with no way out, well, that remains to be seen.
Hmm. Well, let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about the United States and Saudi Arabia here. here, because just yesterday, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul told NBC's Meet the Press that the war in Yemen, which is led by a Saudi-led coalition there, and of course Yemen is a humanitarian catastrophe now, but Senator Paul said that that war actually has no vital security interest for the United States.
I think our involvement in this terrible war is one of the things that engenders more terrorism. As more people die from starvation, as people pick up bomb fragments, when a school bus is killed and on the bomb fragment it says Made in America, it creates more terrorism. So I think it's actually a risk to our national security to be involved with the Saudis, and we should not be aiding and abetting their bombing of civilian areas.
Now, of course, this is coming after several Senate Republicans, following briefings with the CIA, say that there is no doubt in their minds that the Saudi crown prince is linked to or behind the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey here. Now, Jennifer Williams, the Senate is also considering a bill that would call for the withdrawal of U.S. military support of the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. So if this bill passes, how significant would that be, first of all, regarding what's happening in Yemen? And second of all, for the president, who has continued to ally himself with the Saudi crown prince?
Right. It would be significant, I think, in both senses. It's not entirely clear exactly what that would mean in terms of withdrawing support, whether that would mean specifically having, American troops on the ground. Right now, we're doing things like helping the Saudis with targeting, picking the targets that they use for bombing. We're helping things like recently refueling planes, things like intelligence. So not actually like on the ground fighting the war. So it kind of remains to be seen whether there would still be an intelligence sharing relationship, what degree that would actually take. I think it's also more important kind of in the political sense for Trump is that this is kind of really the first time we've seen Congress try to wrest back some of its oversight control of war powers. This is the first kind of vote we've seen on the War Powers Act to really kind of bring back some of the oversight control that Congress is legally supposed to have over U.S. military action abroad. So I think even the fact that this vote got as far as it has, it's the farthest anything like this has gotten with respect to Yemen and Saudi Arabia, I think that alone really speaks to kind of a growing understanding that, one, the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia needs to have a kind of dramatic rethink, and two, that it might be time for Congress to start really rethinking letting the executive branch in particular, but also Trump as president right now, but kind of more generally the executive branch, maintain that level of control and kind of freedom to act in terms of foreign policy without stopping and going, well, okay, what is this supporting? What are the strategic goals this is supporting? Is this right for America? Is this right, morally for the world? And trying to really regain some of that oversight control that they legally have.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to take note that folks listening throughout there are probably wondering why Jennifer's on a phone all of a sudden when she was in a studio beforehand. And everyone, there was a fire alarm that went off in the studio when Jennifer was talking to us. So thank you, Jennifer, by the way, for sticking with us on your phone.
Absolutely.
As the fire situation is being dealt with. I hope everyone's okay there.
I think everyone's fine.
Okay, good. Just a little transparency there, because listeners care about these things. I wanted to explain why that was going on. But Natasha, I mean, you cover national security here, and given what Jennifer said, and we heard Senator Rand Paul there saying that he finally believes that the war in Yemen has no national security interest for the United States. I mean, what's your take on the divide here that's emerging between the president and key Senate Republicans?
Yeah, it's really significant. But I also think that we need to step back and remember the kind of bizarre relationship that the president and his son-in-law have with the Saudi crown prince and the Saudis here. I mean, since the early months of the Trump administration, Jared Kushner, his top Middle East advisor, has been having private, informal conversations with Prince bin Salman on WhatsApp. They are on a first-name basis. They're buddies. And that is extremely – that could be extremely instrumental here in determining, the Trump administration's policy with regard to Saudi Arabia, especially given of course, on top of their personal relationship, Trump's own admission that the Saudis have given him millions and millions of dollars mm-hmm. in money into his properties in New York. And so that is a serious conflict. And I think it's really important now that members of Congress are not necessarily calling the president out on the clear kind of conflicts there, but are kind of going about it in a more roundabout way, saying we need to reexamine what our support for Saudi Arabia is actually about and whether or not it continues to make sense. I think that the pushback we've seen from Trump in holding Saudi Arabia accountable does stem from his financial relationship with Saudi Arabia, stemming back a very long time. And I think that's why the new emoluments case that's moving forward by the attorneys general of Maryland and D.C. could potentially be so significant because, of course, they have now been able to move forward with subpoenas for Trump's businesses in their lawsuit alleging that he has violated the emoluments clause, going back to our first caller's mm-hmm. Question. So all of this is really significant. And I think that it's really important now that Congress is taking a step back and recognizing that this is not normal.
Yeah. Jennifer, give us your take on Jared Kushner's role here, because I think Natasha's exactly right to bring that up. There's been a lot of reporting over the weekend over exactly what Natasha's saying about the sort of very deep and profound relationship between Kushner and the Saudi crown prince. And really, I mean, we are talking about the one of the people that the president himself made a point person for Middle East policy for the United States. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, the reporting that we've seen suggested that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, MBS, as he's commonly called in Washington, that they saw Jared Kushner as an impressionable target, right? So not just that this is like some happenstance, some relationship that the two men, they are, you know, around the same age, they're in their early 30s. You know, it's not some like friendship, some affinity they naturally have, saying, hey, buddy, how's it going on WhatsApp? This is a clear, targeted, you know, plan on the part of the Saudi government to find someone, identify someone, and Jared Kushner in particular. You know, some of the reporting says that, you know, they based this on the fact that he didn't have hardly any knowledge at all mm-hmm. of the Middle East, and he's being appointed, you know, the Middle East envoy, Middle East advisor for Trump and handling the Middle East peace plan. So it definitely seems that it's part of this broader kind of purposeful targeting strategy, and that is part of the problem, you know, with the Trump administration, is that you don't have a lot of experienced, you know, policy people and political operatives who understand the risks, who understand what it's like to be manipulated by foreign governments, and who are very, you know, susceptible to this kind of manipulation. And we're seeing that play out, you know, not just with Jared Kushner, but in other areas as well.
Yeah. Well, James Holman, let me turn back to you here and get your quick take on the Senate considering a proposal to withdraw U.S. support of that Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Because on the one hand, we've discussed about if it passes, why that would be rather significant and meaningful. But on the other hand, does it really do anything to change the fundamentals of the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia? I mean, we heard Natasha and Jennifer a minute or two ago talking about sort of that there's a question of an economic question, a strategic issue here, but also now the moral cost of this relationship.
Well, I think that, Meghna, the U.S. has more leverage than the Trump administration thinks. Mm-hmm. The Saudis obviously control a huge amount of oil output. They have the ability to reduce the supply. But the Saudis need the United States to counter Iran and to be its key ally in the region. So I do think that you could cut off the support for the effort in Yemen without destroying the broader relationship. On the other hand, there's always a risk that if you kind of bother the Saudis on Yemen, they're going to retaliate in other ways. There could be second and third order consequences we don't anticipate. That's what makes foreign policy always a challenge. But it is an interesting moral debate that the Senate is finally having after putting off for years and years. And it is really something to see Lindsey Graham and Rand Paul, who in many ways are on the opposite sides on foreign policy of the Republican conference, working together in cahoots.
Right. Well, in the last several minutes that we have here, Natasha, Jennifer, and James, I'm reminded by news today that even in the past several weeks, there have been very bad and challenging days in Washington. But there is one person in the United States orbit of allies who's consistently been having it worse, and that is Theresa May in the United Kingdom with all the turmoil around Brexit, because today the Prime Minister in the United Kingdom is saying that a parliamentary vote that was scheduled for tomorrow on the Brexit deal will be delayed. And she confirms that the vote is being delayed because she admits she would have lost by a significant margin. So, Jennifer Williams, every time I feel like I've fully wrapped my head around what next steps in Brexit are, everything explodes all over again. So where does this leave the United Kingdom vis-a-vis the European Union?
Yeah, you know, and I apologize, it's very noisy where I am.
It's all right.
I'm so sorry. You know, I think over and over we've seen again that with the Brexit negotiations, with Theresa May's attempt to get a plan through, we've seen that essentially it ends up with no one being happy. So the current deal that Theresa May is trying to push through, you know, the hard Brexiteers, the people who really wanted a harder kind of stop with the European Union, a harder break, they're unhappy with this plan. The people who wanted to remain are unhappy with this plan. The EU says we're not going to negotiate a new plan. It seems it's kind of all or nothing on this, and it doesn't look very likely that it's going to happen. So, you know, over and over, you kind of end up just looking back at the situation going, you know, what is happening?
Right.
The Brits have a lovely word. They use omni-shambles. And it definitely seems to describe this entire process. And it's, you know, it's in some ways funny for us to laugh, you know, the U.S. kind of watching this other thing happen. But there are real people's lives at stake here and, you know, real economic damage that can be done. And it's really scary to see a country kind of implode, you know, in front of our very eyes like this.
No, point taken. I mean, it is the single most important thing in the United Kingdom right now. And actually, obviously, hugely important for Europe as well. But my hats are always off to the Brits in coming up with phrasing that does bring an ironic smile to your mouth. But Natasha here, now I'm beginning to wonder, just, you know, quickly, your thoughts about how much longer Theresa May stay as prime minister.
Yeah, so she's in a pretty impossible position, and she has been from day one. I mean, this is a job that no one wanted. She has steadfastly maintained, you know, for months now that her Brexit deal would be the blueprint for the post-Brexit future of the UK as an independent trading nation. And she has told reporters essentially that there's no plan B for mm-hmm. losing the vote in Parliament. So that leaves the big question here. I mean, if she knows that she doesn't have the votes and there's no plan B, then what next? And I think that Jennifer put it really well. I mean, when you see a country kind of imploding before our very eyes, I mean, what happens? I don't think that any of this could be foreseen, especially not in 2016 when you know, up until the very last minute, it seemed clear that Brexit was not going to pass, that it was going to fail. So 2 years on, there's still no plan here. And I think that Theresa May is poised to perhaps, you know, take the fall. President Trump certainly has, you know, gone to great lengths to criticize her and say, you know, that the deal that she wants would not allow the UK to be an independent trading nation, to which she, you know, pushed back and said, actually, no, we would be able to strike our own trade deals, et cetera, et cetera. And she rebuked him at the G20. So that relationship is fracturing as well. But I do think that, you know, I feel for her. I think everyone does. She really was put in the worst possible position here.
Yeah. And trying to build fractious coalitions, which turns out to not be possible, at least this week. James Homan, we've got about 30 seconds left. Last thought this hour goes to you.
I think that the ties between what's happening in England and what's happening in the United States are relevant. There are parallels and echoes. There was a populist revolt that led to Brexit, and we're still experiencing the aftershocks of our own populist revolt here in the United States.
Well, James Homan is national political correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the Daily 202 newsletter. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Jennifer Williams, foreign editor at Vox and co-host of the weekly international podcast Worldly. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us and sticking with us through even fire alarms there in Washington. So thank you.
Anytime. Thank you.
And Natasha Bertrand, staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers national security and the intelligence community. Natasha, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thanks so much.
And folks, keep your comments and thoughts coming. You can go to our website, onpointradio.org, or send us a tweet at On Point Radio. We're also on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.